Welcome to Market View with Ike Iosa and Friends. This show that not only reveals and analyzes the inside story on today's market news, but also uncovers the areas where investors can make money right now. Market Views with Ike Iosa and Friends is being brought to you by GM Capital Group.
Good morning. I'm Mike Ayoshi, your host for Market Views. This guest, my good friend, Mr. Glenn Neely. Hi, Glenn. How do you do?
I'm doing fine, Mike. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Glenn, today we're going to be doing part two of the interview that we started about 6 weeks ago.
Yes, in almost 2 months or something like that.
Yeah. Would you like to give us a synopsis to reconnect with what we said last time before we go further?
Okay. Well, the main topic is human progress, and it's subtitled From the Ice Age to the Space Age and Beyond. And in part one, I pointed out that I had been for many years trying to figure out a way to quantify human progress and economic progress way before there was any available data, because the data that is available on economic data, that is only available for about 300 years, which was seriously limiting my ability to analyze human progress going back to some of the first civilizations and all through the last 10,000 years or so. So that left me with the only option of using history and archaeology to try to devise a way to quantify human progress back to the last ice age, which is, based on the discussion, the best time to start the new assessment of human progress, since that was the beginning of a complete change in the way that man lived for hundreds of thousands of years. In part one, I covered the five basic human needs that were developed by Abraham Maslow, which are physiological needs, safety needs, the need for love and belongingness, the need for self-esteem and self-actualization. And I discussed how each need level must be met before the next one can be addressed. So you start from the bottom and work your way up. For that reason, this sets into motion a predictable sequence of individual human behavior. So if you know what a person currently needs and which needs have not been met, it's pretty easy to predict what they're going to do next and what they'll do first, second, third, fourth, and fifth. I observed also that for the most part, history is the study of extremes, and they're studying things like who did the most, who killed the most, who conquered the most, who built the most, suffered the most, discovered the most, invented the most, and that such extremes require mass participation, that it takes many people doing similar things at the same time to create these events we call history. Maslow's observations were based on individual human motivation, and they were very interesting. But to my knowledge, they were never applied to the behavior of groups, large groups of people. When that's done, it becomes easy to see how the focus in the behavior of an entire society can be predicted as they each, as a group, pursue the individual human needs, but as a group, one step at a time, and that they follow a natural sequence. And the need for a consistent supply of food forced the development of agriculture. The need for safety created the need for shelter and weapons. The need for love and belongingness instigated the formation of towns and cities. The need for self-esteem and status promoted social structure, laws and rules and rulers, political leaders. And finally, the need for self-actualization is what fosters creativity and invention, and those things create increasing efficiency through technology. So in conclusion, I said that human action is directly connected to human need, and that the fulfillment of each need requires very specific action. So since historians primarily study and record mass human action, that I decided it was possible that a study of history would provide clues on the need level being pursued by the masses at any point in time, which would then give me an idea of the current economic vitality, you might say, of a society and where they stand in a progression. So it was with that foundation that we are now moving into part two.
Okay, and we're all ears.
Okay. The great challenge for part two was identifying the most important periods in history and classifying the level of need of each period in history.
Okay, when you say identifying the most important things, the most important periods in history, in terms of what? Just need?
Well, from every perspective. In other words, looking at encyclopedias, studying human civilization, wars, famines, all these different kinds of events that stood out in history that historians reported about as being mass human activities, and then recording them every 100 years for the last 120 centuries and giving numerical values to each period. I was going to go into detail on this later, but that's what was required. And I studied basically 10 to 12,000 years of human history to arrive at the information that I'm going to be presenting today.
Okay.
Okay. Then after all that part is done, we're going to take wave theory and apply that to the information so that you can get a very clear idea of where we stand on a, you know, epic basis, on a human evolutionary epic basis. And that'll decide, help us to decide whether we should be optimistic or pessimistic about the future. And to get this started, we need to first establish some standards and procedures about how this would be done. So let's move on to chart 19.
Okay.
Each chart has a number at the top right-hand corner. The concept of isolation, I had to, just to limit the amount of work that's required, it took me, I think, 6 to 12 months to put this all together. This was done quite a long time ago, by the way. But it took a lot of information, and I started to realize that, sort of like the stock market, we don't say what the entire, every single company in the whole country is doing, but we look at the broad averages and we use that as a proxy for overall economic prosperity. So I decided that I was going to have to do the same thing, that I would have to pick the region of the world that was producing the most news, the most inventions, the greatest civilizations, the most wars, or, you know, whatever, where most of the history was being made from the very beginning of human civilization. So that was crucial, just to limit the amount of work required to do this and to just get a good proxy for how things were going to proceed. So let's move on to, you don't move on, but I'm going to move on to the next page here.
Okay.
The research approach, I decided that I shouldn't mix different societies together. There was obviously societies emerging in China and India and Central America and South America, but where most of the activity was occurring, especially early on, was in the area we now call the Middle East, Europe, and Northern Africa. And it was within that region of the world that the first colonized zones appeared in the whole world, along the Nile River Valley and the Tigris Euphrates River Valley. These were the largest inhabited areas on Earth at the time, and they therefore received the widest coverage of events by historians than any other area of the world.
Okay.
That's where I focused all of my attention for this project. So that would be like the Dow or the S&P, and the other countries might be, you know, the NASDAQ or something else. The analysis procedures I had to use were that most periods in history stand out dramatically in one aspect or another, such as they might be recognized for, a civilization might be recognized for its great art or its music or philosophy or architecture or scientific discoveries, or maybe even wars and famines and things like that. So I had to look for those kinds of things in the historical record so that it would give me an idea of what the living standards were at each 100-year period. Okay, so let's move on to chart 20. The next thing I had to do in the research process was deduce what mass human events could be categorized based on human need. Remember, it's the need that compels people into action, and those actions will reflect what the current need level of the society is as a whole. If you're studying history, you're mostly studying mass activity, so whatever the masses were doing, the majority of the people were doing is a reflection of what the majority needed at that time. Then I would need to relate the need levels, sort of spell them out to what specific actions would be instigated by certain need levels.
Okay.
So what I had to do is sort of externalize need on a physical action basis. And the physical action, of course, is what the historians are reporting. So we would have to decide what someone would do, what activity they would participate in, if they were working on physiological needs, or what they would do if they were focused on safety needs, etc. So I had to rename Maslow's levels of need a little bit to better associate them with the actions you would take, or the psychological frame of mind you might have at each stage of development. And then details in each action will be covered here, and that'll relate directly to peers in history, which you'll see later. Let's see, let's move on to the next chart, which is page 20.
Okay.
So this shows the first level of need. It's externalizing the physiological need, which basically is the compulsion to survive or the survival instinct. So obviously if you have the need to survive, if things are that bad, that would be associated with things like wars, invasions, panics, famines, and things like that. It would be a very aggressive physical kind of period, more inwardly directed than outwardly directed, and your actions are specifically designed for, you know, surviving. A lack of law and order could be typical of such a period. Invasions of another territory, migrations might be possible, things along those lines. Now, move to the next page, which is still chart 20, but it's just the next page. When you externalize the safety need, that could be things like establishing security, building homes and shelters, protecting your assets. Less effort at this stage would be spent on surviving, obviously, and more on just protecting what you have. You begin to think more about future threats to your survival, not just current threats. And so you might start building walls around cities, hoarding supplies of things, making weapons for your defense, not necessarily to fight, but just to protect yourself. From a historian's point of view, this need will most likely manifest in the building of shelters, as I mentioned earlier, securing a few food supplies, agriculture, the digging of wells, setting up of dams, making of clothes and weapons, and so forth. Let's move on to the next page. Externalize the need for love and belongingness. This is sort of working for acceptance. You start to build a culture, a society, sort of a business kind of environment, which obviously requires cities and towns and things like that. It'd be a more materialistic, productive, social period of development, and people would be more apt to organize and cooperate, form laws, have political leaders and things like that. Let's move on to the next page for externalizing self-esteem or status. This would be sort of consolidating your progress, your position of power, trying to influence people, more involved in political endeavors, conquering other countries, trying to spread your influence around, establishment of kingdoms and empires and things like that would be typical of such a period. Go on to the next page. So externalizing the need for self-actualization, and this is the last stage of development, and it's mostly a mental stage of development. It's trying to understand the world around you, having a very deep curiosity for the unknown, trying to discover new things. And this can only happen on a broad basis when everyone is pretty comfortable with their survival, that there's nothing to worry about, that society is structured well, there's things are calm, safe. So it allows you to start thinking about things beyond yourself and beyond the current world and possibly inventing new things. And so that would be the final stage of human progress. This could be also on a mass level be associated with things like economic manias and bubbles, scientific discoveries, and so forth, our technological advances. I guess we want to chart 21.
All right.
Okay, so to do this research, I had to look through an unbelievable amount of information over, like I said earlier, about 6 to 12 months. And some of the stuff I obtained was, or looked at, was information in encyclopedias going back about 10 to 12,000 years. I looked for evidence of wars, invasions, famines, pestilence, economic panics, crashes, depressions, or things like the building of shelters and barriers, periods of cooperation and organization, or periods of material abundance. In addition, I was looking for things like the creation of famous literature, the visual arts and music, the appearance of kingdoms or empires or royalty, and finally, advances in philosophy, discoveries in science and technology, in mathematics, and evidence of economic manias and bubbles. To do this, I obtained information from all kinds of different sources. This was back when the Foundation for the Study of Cycles was still in existence, and they had a lot of cool information, things like Wheeler's War Index, which went back to 600 BC, and it made it easy to identify periods of growth and decay and mass psychological pessimism and optimism. What they called the Mass Excitability Index, back to 400 BC. The time spans of major civilizations back from 10,000 BC. World cataclysms from 5,000 BC. Periods of mass migration, which would indicate mass dissatisfaction. Trends in population growth from 8,000 BC. And stock market data back to 1695 AD. And evidence of real estate booms and busts.
Okay.
We can move on to, that was chart 21. There was two pages there. Then moving on to chart 22.
That's a very interesting chart.
Yeah, this is when it gets good. So what we've been building up to here is how all this could be quantified down to a numerical value for each period. Every 100 years, I gave one single numerical value representing the predominant prevailing focus of society at that time.
All right.
And going back to the beginning of the Ice Age, between 10,000 and 9,000 BC, there was virtually no evidence of civilizations, towns, cities, or anything. All the evidence suggested that we were, as humans, just surviving from day to day, so that period got nothing but ones. Then right after 9,000 BC, the first signs of agriculture started to emerge, which was an indication of security attainment, security of food supplies. So that period was given a rating of 2. Then late in the 9th millennium, the first walled city called Jericho appeared, and so I gave that period a rating of 3 since that started to show social organization. Jericho eventually came to an end in 7350 BC, and with no other known cities in existence at the time, the only thing I could assume was that the social structure broke down. But since the agricultural revolution was still going strong, we had to assume that security was still the primary need being fulfilled, so that period was given a rating of 2.
Okay.
Archaeological evidence indicates that security remained the primary concern from about 6250 BC, and with the rise of the city Catal Hayuk, that's when it started to change again. So that was actually 6250 BC. So what I said earlier, from 7350 BC until 6250, there was nothing to indicate anything but just agriculture and security, focus on security. So in 6250, with the city Catal Hayuk, that indicated the social structure started to increase again, so I got a level of 3. Now the next part got a lot more complicated because the world population started to increase dramatically after that, which meant a lot more events and things to study. But the most dramatic change occurred when the Sumerians invented writing around 3500 BC. At the same time, the wheel and plow and the sail were invented. For that reason, that period got a rating of level 4 because it was a heightened level of not only prosperity but invention and things like that. Powerful city-states started to emerge in Sumer around 32 BC. Moving on to, I think it's the next page. It's still chart 22, but it's on the next page. The Age of the Pyramids from 2685 to 2180 ushered in one of the greatest, longest-lasting periods in human civilization, and the effort, even today, required to produce things like the pyramids still amazes the world. So that period easily got a rating of 5 for its technological sophistication and advances at that time. Okay, moving on to the period where it shows the 1600 BC. By 2200 BC, the largest and fastest decline in human living standards began with the virtual onslaught of wars, invasions, migrations, and social unrest. And then by 1600 BC, with all this going on, the rating had dropped all the way back down to 1. Over a period of 1,000 years, culminating in one of the most respected and imitated civilizations of all time, the Greek civilization, that brought advances in philosophy and science and architecture and mathematics, that period obviously got a rating of 5. Then another 1,000 years passed, and another series of wars and invasions occurred. The Roman Empire came and went with a peak rating of 4, and the Dark Ages brought in one of the worst periods in human civilization with plagues and pestilence and wars and invasions. So the Dark Ages clearly deserves, probably more than any other period, a level of 1. Finally, the Renaissance commenced with, after the plague subsided, instituting one of the most inventive, ingenious-packed periods in history, once again bringing the level rating back to 5. Then the American Revolution began, and several other revolutions, returning the survival quotient back down to 2. Then the independence of America, we saw the greatest period of invention the world has ever known in the 1800s, earning that period a rating of 5. And last but not least, the World Wars, representing one of the most destructive periods in man's history, returns the rating back to level 2.
All right.
So overall, we're dealing with 120 centuries of information, and when you put it all together, it produces the plot on chart 23, which is one of the more interesting charts I've ever probably created.
It sure is.
And the most fascinating part about this is, you know, obviously you can read through all the different peaks and troughs and why I gave them the ratings that I did. The fascinating part about this is when you look at it from a wave theory standpoint, you immediately notice there's wave types of behavior in the structure. For example, the advance from the end of the Ice Age up to 9,000 or 8,000 BC, if you consider that wave 1, you can see it's followed by sort of ABC kind of correction for wave 2. And then you have this big move up to the Age of the Pyramids for wave 3. Now, since we're only dealing with numbers between 5 and 1, there obviously is going to be overlap here. But you'll notice a dramatic difference in behavior after the peak of the pyramid. It goes way down, way up, way down, showing clear alternation under wave 3 between what could be a fourth wave and what could have been a 2 wave back in the 8,000 to 5,000 BC period. And then the advance again from the Dark Ages starting the next sort of impulsive kind of advance. So if you go to the next chart, chart 24,
all right,
it shows superimposing a sort of orthodox wave pattern on top of this human progress plot, and you can get a much better idea of where we probably are in the progression of man. So this is what I think, this is where I think we are in a sort of a epic cycle, our grand super cycle, and it indicates that we still have quite a bit to go to the upside, which is perfectly consistent with what I've been saying for about 20 years or something like that. If you move on to the very next chart, which is chart 29, the other charts were purposely left out because they no longer applied to this situation. They were more short-term projections. But on chart 29, it shows my long-term forecast that I've had for, you know, nearly 20 years, and showing what I thought would be the progression of the stock market, which has worked out pretty nicely for the last 16, 17 years. And it's showing the market continuing to go up and peaking much, much later. And this happens to coincide very nicely with the projected peak in world populations around 2040 and as late as 2130. These estimates are important because when human population stops growing, it's almost always associated with economic progress coming to an end. Increasing population always creates increasing prosperity and and growth for a period of time. When it starts to decline, it usually indicates declining economic progress. So this is the sort of net result of all of this, and I think it indicates that we should definitely be optimistic about the future of not only the United States, but of the world for at least the next 50 to 100 years.
Let me ask you a question. Now that you mentioned the future of the United States and the rest of the world, I hear many people saying to me that the era of American global economic and military domination is over, and mainly due to the rise of China. What do you think?
Well, based on this, I'd say it's probably not going to come to an end for maybe another 40 to 50 years. I can't say if we're going to be the only world power, but at this time it doesn't look very promising for anybody else to take our position for at least 10 or 20 years, I would say. But just looking at the chart, I would assume that we're going to probably stay in a pretty dominant position around the world for quite a long time. But realize that what I said in my long-term forecast 16, 17 years ago is that the world is moving toward a more capitalistic, productive kind of society where countries will become more and more capitalistic, less and less communistic and socialistic, and this competition is going to create an incredible worldwide prosperity for at least the next 50, maybe 100 years. And that's really the driving force here is technology spreads around the world, and as that technology spreads, people become more aware of what life is like in the freer parts of the world, and they want it, and they're starting to demand it, and that's going to just change the standard of living for everyone around the world, and that competition is going to be good for everyone. So America will start to have some major competition in different areas probably in the next 10 to 20 years, but I don't see any reason for them to lose their position of power until probably the mid this century or later.
Glenn, anything else you'd like to add for today? Any other thoughts, observations?
No, that's pretty much it. And this is hopefully the last time I have to go through this kind of worship to produce a talk.
Well, Glenn, thank you so much. Have a great day.
Okay, thanks, Ike.